الحمد لله الحمد لله الحمد لله نحمده ونستعينه ونستغفره ونؤمن به ونتوكل عليه ونعوذ بالله من شرور أنفسنا ومن سيئات أعمالنا من يهده الله فلا مضل له ومن يضلله فلا هادي له ونشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له ونشهد أن سيدنا ونبينا وحبيبنا وشفيعنا وطبيب قلوبنا ومولانا محمدا عبده ورسوله الذي أرسل إلى الناس كافة وإلى الخلق عامة بشيرا ونذيرا بين يدي الساعة قال الله تبارك وتعالى في شأن حبيبه إن الله وملائكته يصلون على النبي يا أيها الذين آمنوا صلوا عليه وسلموا تسليما اللهم صل وسلم وأنعم وزد وتفضل وبارك على سيد السادات وأفضل الموجودات وأشرف الموجودات وأحسن الموجودات وأكرم الموجودات وأجمل الموجودات وأكمل الموجودات سيدنا ومولانا محمد رسول الله صلى الله تعالى عليه وعلى جميع الأنبياء والمرسلين وعلى جميع ملائكة المعصومين وعلى جميع عباد الصالحين أما بعد لقد قال الله تبارك وتعالى في كلامه القديم العظيم أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم لقد من الله على المؤمنين إذ بعث فيهم رسولا صدق الله مولانا العظيم وبلغ رسوله النبي الحبيب الكريم ونحن على ذلك من الشاهدين والشاكرين Mr. Chairman, my dear brothers and sisters in Islam and brothers and sisters in humanity, may God bless you all with the spirit of truth, justice and duty. The organizers of this function have not fixed up any particular topic for this evening, although I expected them to do so. Consequently, I would like to speak in a general manner about what Islam stands for. As we all very well know, the history of mankind is the history of ideas. We know from history that during the course of time, numerous great teachers emerged among different nations and in different communities, and they gave a message which created a stir in the environment. There were some people who accepted the message, there were others who opposed it. But it very often happened that when a new movement came, it was as if it was an answer to some of the needs of that age and of that community. And consequently, every new movement in ideas created a change in the course of history. But to realize the importance of all these movements and to evaluate them, one has got to undertake a sort of comparative study and also of the problems which existed in a certain community where a certain great teacher arose and the manner in which those problems were solved. When the Holy Prophet Muhammad alayhi salatu wasalam appeared in Arabia 1400 years ago, the condition of that country, the conditions which obtained in that country, and the conditions which obtained in the world at large shall have to be taken into consideration in order to find out the nature of the message which he gave and the contribution which he made to the cause of mankind. There are different facets of human life and different problems in the light of which the state of affairs as they were to be found at that time can be assessed. When we look to the condition of Arabia itself, where the Holy Prophet Muhammad alayhi salatu wasalam was born and where he preached, we find that the Arabian community of that time was a community which was the most backward in every manner possible. It was a community, so to say, of barbarians who were divided among themselves on the basis of tribalism and who had absolutely no concept that all human beings can form one family or all human beings are really one family. They did not accept even to consider the people of Arabia itself as one family. And this caste system and this tribalism and this parochialism, sectionalism, or whatever you may call it, existed to an extent that very often these tribes indulged in wars with one another on the most trivial pretext. And sometimes these wars continued even beyond one century. They were a very ferocious people. Their moral standards were very low, which can be understood by trying to think about how far and what measure drunkenness or alcoholism, which has again become the bane of this modern society, how far alcoholism and gambling and sexual promiscuity and immoralities of various types were to be found among them. They were barbaric to an extent that at their sacred festivals they would become naked, absolutely, and dance, men and women, which shows that they did not have any consciousness beyond the primitive consciousness, which we might call it. Even a primitive human being whose mentality has not been perverted would like to use leaves of trees for concealing certain parts of the body. But it was a sort of similar condition as we find nowadays in this progress of so-called civilization, where people think that they can demonstrate their progressiveness in terms of nudity. And every government, even the South African government, probably is finding this problem as a headache as to how far to tell and in what manner to convince the people that this is not progress, but it is retrogression. They did not know of any constitution. As a matter of fact, entire humanity had not been able to produce any constitution of the state up to that time. And it was unimaginable for these people of Arabia of that time to think in terms of a state and in terms of a constitution. They only believed in the law of might is right, which is called the law of the jungle. They took pride in being illiterate and ignorant. They used to say that to acquire education is the work of the merchant class only, while they thought that they were born to be soldiers, and as soldiers it was insulting for them to acquire any literacy, not to speak of higher knowledge. And consequently, in the Arabia of those days, there were people, of course, who had got some education, who had gone to Palestine or Syria or to Yemen in the southwest, and had acquired some knowledge, but these people could be counted on fingertips. There were no schools. There was no conception of a library. There was no conception of books. There was no conception of cultivation of knowledge as such. And this state of affairs was found not only in Arabia, but Europe was sunk in medieval darkness. Its condition was similar. The African communities, which have not been unfortunately able to rise to their height up to this day, they were also in the same state. India and China, where there had been great upsurges of knowledge and culture during the previous ages preceding that, some 1,000 years ago, 5,000 or 4,000 years ago from now, they were also in the same sad state. This person, the Holy Prophet Muhammad alayhi salatu wasalam, he lost his father before his birth. He lost his mother soon after his birth. He was brought up by his grandfather, later on by his uncle. He had absolutely no means which are provided to a child for his education and training. But this orphan child of Amina, who was illiterate, born among an illiterate people, and born in a period of history where ignorance was virtue, this man, when he came forward to give the message, try to understand the revolutionary character and try to understand as to from where could it come. It is said that when he was 40 years old, he was in the cave of Hira, where he had started going since the age of 25. And to him appeared the Archangel Gabriel, whom he did not know before. He saw this angel and he saw a writing. And the angel said to him, "Iqra, read." He answered, "Ma ana biqari'in," "I do not know how to read." And in that he depicted not only his condition, that he was illiterate, he was unlettered, but also the condition of the community and of the world at large. Then it is said that the angel said to him, "Iqra," and he again answered in the same manner. Then it is said that the angel recited, "Iqra bismi rabbika allazi khalaq," "Read in the name of thy Lord who has created the entire world and has created knowledge." "Iqra wa rabbuka al-akram," "Read, for thy Lord is most honorable and bestoweth honor." "Allazi 'allama bil qalam," "Who bestoweth honor through the cultivation and communication of knowledge with the help of the pen." "'Allama al-insana ma lam ya'lam," in order to cause the stream of knowledge to flow from one generation to another and from one community to another. How amazing that the first message which this unlettered person living in the wilderness of Arabia of those days, where he had been surrounded for all these 40 years with unlettered and uneducated people, the first message that he claimed to have got from God, this word was "read." And not only the word "read," but that message mentioned that God Almighty is going to make those people alone honorable who are going to use the pen for the cultivation of knowledge. And the community which he was going to build up and establish under that message, it was made in this first revelation, one of the functions of that community, to unearth the buried treasures of knowledge, to revive them, and to propagate them. "Allama al-insana ma lam ya'lam." He got the message and gave the message. And what do we find? This was, of course, the first message that he got, and he communicated it to mankind. Then he continued to get messages for 23 years, and those messages are recorded and compiled in the book which is called the Quran, the reading, because the first command had come, "Iqra," so the book is also called the Quran. It is a book which has got to be read and reread, which unfortunately the Muslims of today have completely forgotten. And because it has got to be read and reread, because the book is from the author of nature, from the author of this world, from the creator of this world. It has unfathomable layers of wisdom which can be found out only through reading and reading and re-reading and reading again. And consequently, the very name of this book is reading, the reading, Al-Qur'an. What was this message which the Qur'an brought? What was the message which this great man gave in the words of the Qur'an and in his own exposition of the Qur'an? Even today you will find that there is not much love lost between the followers of different creeds, between the followers of different religions. It is considered to be an act of piety to insult the follower of the religion of another religion. It is considered to be an act of the greatest virtue to hold the follower of another religion in contempt. But what did this man teach? What others had taught, I am not standing here to speak about that, but what did this man teach? He taught mankind to be first of all true to itself. He taught every human being to be first of all true to himself or herself, because he preached the basic doctrine which was not preached before him with the same emphasis. He preached the doctrine in the verse of the Qur'an, وَلَقَدْ كَرَّمْنَا بَنِي آدَمْ, where God Almighty says, I have made every human being, in virtue of his being a human being, honorable. And consequently, this great man laid down the law. All human beings are born free and equal. And it is an insult to humanity to insult another person. He preached the doctrine, which Muslims also have forgotten now, very unfortunately. He preached the doctrine, and he gave this motto to the Muslims. Of course, it was meant for all mankind to follow, but it is an obligation on the Muslims who call themselves his followers. He laid down the motto of life, hate evil but not the evildoer, and appreciate good wherever it is found. Read the Quran and try to find out the outlook of this man as to why he was behaving in the manner that he was behaving, what was his attitude in propagating his message which he gave, which he regarded with the utmost depth of conviction as the absolute truth. A conviction which was so intense that there was absolutely no question of a compromise. But what was his attitude? What was his attitude towards the followers of other ideas, towards his worst enemies, towards his worst opponents? Read Surah Al-Kahf. And in this chapter, read the verse, فَلَعَلَّكَ بَاخِعٌ نَفْسَكَ عَلَىٰ آثَارِهِمْ إِلَّمْ يُؤْمِنُوا بِهَذَا الْحَدِيثِ أَسَفَىٰ. God Almighty tells him, O Prophet, you love these infidels, these enemies of your message, who are all the time persecuting you and your followers. You love them so intensely that because they do not come to the right path which you are preaching to them, which is the path of salvation for them, you remain so grieved at this that if this grief stays, it is going to take away your life. This is the translation of the verse. فَلَعَلَّكَ بَاخِعٌ نَفْسَكَ عَلَىٰ أَثَارِهِمْ إِنْ لَمْ يُؤْمِنُوا بِهَذَا الْحَدِيثِ أَسَفًا. Of course, his blind enemies, even today, the so-called Western Orientalists, for the past so many centuries, have been blackmailing him. And even today, if you go to Europe, you will find in those countries tender children, children of tender age being taught in their schools, printed in their books. Muhammad was a robber. He was a barbarian. He was a savage. And he built up a band of workers, of followers, who went out into the world with the sword in one hand and the Quran in the other to convert the people by force of arms and at the point of sword. There is no other instance of calling a white thing black. As black an instance as this. It was he who in the history of mankind laid down the law for the conversion of another person into Islam, laid down the law of freedom of conscience. The Quran proclaims, La ikraha fi al-deen. Nobody can be compelled to accept any belief. There can be no compulsion in religion. This is the Quran. And the Islamic law lays down that if any Muslim tries the means of temptation or threat to convert a non-Muslim into Islam, it is the duty of the Islamic State to punish this Muslim and to help the person who has been threatened. Because according to the Quran, conviction without a rational basis and without the proper belief, belief without proper conviction is an absolute superstition. And every human being has dignity in his own right that he cannot be forced to abjure a certain belief and to say that he believes in something else. This is an insult to a human being according to the Quran. And God has made every human being possessor of dignity. Who was giving this message? Try to keep in your mind that age. Try to keep in your mind that environment. Those people out of whom he had sprung. People talk about fraternity, liberty and equality, that it was preached by Rousseau and Voltaire. Rousseau and Voltaire only stole those ideas from the Quran. These things were preached 1400 years ago by this great man. And what a greatness he had. He preached the doctrine of Alhamdulillah,
nahmaduhu wa nasta'inuhu wa nastaghfiruhu wa nu'minu bihi wa natawakkalu alayhi. ونعوذ بالله من شرور أنفسنا ومن سيئات أعمالنا من يهده الله فلا مضل له ومن يضلله فلا هادي له ونشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له ونشهد أن سيدنا ونبينا وحبيبنا وشفيعنا وطبيب قلوبنا ومولانا محمدا عبده ورسوله الذي أرسل إلى الناس كافة وإلى الخلق عامة بشيرا ونذيرا بين يدي الساعة قال الله تبارك وتعالى في شأن حبيبه إن الله وملائكته يصلون على النبي يا أيها الذين آمنوا صلوا عليه وسلموا تسليما اللهم صل وسلم وأنعم وزد وتفضل وبارك على سيد السادات وأفضل الموجودات وأشرف الموجودات وأحسن الموجودات وأكرم الموجودات وأجمل الموجودات وأكمل الموجودات سيدنا ومولانا محمد رسول الله صلى الله تعالى عليه وعلى جميع الأنبياء والمرسلين وعلى جميع ملائكة المعصومين وعلى جميع عباد الصالحين أما بعد لقد قال الله تبارك وتعالى في كلامه القديم العظيم أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم لقد من الله على المؤمنين إذ بعث فيهم رسولا صدق الله مولانا العظيم وبلغ رسوله النبي الحبيب الكريم ونحن على ذلك من الشاهدين والشاكرين Mr. Chairman, my dear brothers and sisters in Islam, and brothers and sisters in humanity. May God bless you all with the spirit of truth, justice and duty. The organizers of this function have not fixed up any particular topic for this evening. Although I expected them to do so, consequently, I would like to speak in a general manner about what Islam stands for. As we all very well know, the history of mankind is the history of ideas. We know from history that during the course of time, numerous great teachers emerged among different nations and in different communities, and they gave a message which created a stir in the environment. There were some people who accepted the message, there were others who opposed it. But it very often happened that when a new movement came, it was as if it was an answer to some of the needs of that age and of that community. And consequently, every new movement in ideas created a change in the course of history. But to realize
the importance of all these movements and to evaluate them, one has got to undertake a sort of comparative study and also of the problems which existed in a certain community where a certain great teacher arose and the manner in which those problems were solved. When the Holy Prophet Muhammad alayhi salatu wasalam appeared in Arabia 1400 years ago, the condition of that country, the conditions which obtained in that country, and the conditions which obtained in the world at large shall have to be taken into consideration in order to find out the nature of the message which he gave and the contribution which he made to the cause of mankind. There are different facets of human life and different problems in the light of which the state of affairs as they were to be found at that time can be assessed. When we look to the condition of Arabia itself, where the Holy Prophet Muhammad alayhi salatu wasalam was born and where he preached, we find that the Arabian community of that time was a community which was the most backward in every manner possible. It was a community, so to say, of barbarians who were divided among themselves on the basis of tribalism and who had absolutely no concept that all human beings can form one family, or all human beings are really one family. They did not accept even to consider the people of Arabia itself as one family. And this caste system and this tribalism and this parochialism, sectionalism, or whatever you may call it, existed to an extent that very often these tribes indulged in wars with one another on the most trivial pretext, and sometimes these wars continued even beyond one century. They were a very ferocious people. Their moral standards were very low, which can be understood by trying to think about how far and what measure drunkenness or alcoholism, which has again become the bane of this modern society, how far alcoholism and gambling and sexual promiscuity and immoralities of various types were to be found among them. They were barbaric to an extent that at their sacred festivals they would become naked absolutely and dance, men and women, which shows that they did not have any consciousness beyond the primitive consciousness, which we might call it. Even a primitive human being whose mentality has not been perverted would like to use leaves of trees for concealing certain parts of the body. But it was a sort of similar condition as we find nowadays in this progress of so-called civilization, where people think that they can demonstrate their progressiveness in terms of nudity, and every government, even the South African government, probably is finding this problem as a headache as to how far to tell and in what manner to convince the people that this is not progress but it is retrogression. They did not know of any constitution. As a matter of fact, entire humanity had not been able to produce any constitution of the state up to that time. And it was unimaginable for these people of Arabia of that time to think in terms of a state and in terms of a constitution. They only believed in the law of might is right, which is called the law of the jungle. They took pride in being illiterate and ignorant. They used to say that to acquire education is the work of the merchant class only, while they thought that they were born to be soldiers, and as soldiers it was insulting for them to acquire any literacy, not to speak of higher knowledge. And consequently, in the Arabia of those days, there were people, of course, who had got some education, who had gone to Palestine or Syria or to Yemen and the southwest and had acquired some knowledge, but these people could be counted on fingertips. There were no schools. There was no conception of a library. There was no conception of books. There was no conception of cultivation of knowledge as such. And this state of affairs was found not only in Arabia, but Europe was sunk in medieval darkness. Its condition was similar. The African communities, which have not been unfortunately able to rise to their height up to this day, they were also in the same state. India and China, where there had been great upsurges of knowledge and culture during the previous ages, preceding that, some 1,000 years ago, 5,000 or 4,000 years ago from now, they were also in the same sad state. This person, the Holy Prophet Muhammad alayhi salatu wasalam, he lost his father before his birth. He lost his mother soon after his birth. He was brought up by his grandfather, later on by his uncle. He had absolutely no means which are provided to a child for his education and training. But this orphan child of Amina, who was illiterate, born among an illiterate people, and born in a period of history where ignorance was virtue, this man, when he came forward to give the message, try to understand the revolutionary character and try to understand as to from where could it come. It is said that when he was 40 years old, he was in the cave of Hira, where he had started going since the age of 25. And to him appeared the Archangel Gabriel, whom he did not know before. He saw this angel and he saw a writing. And the angel said to him, "Iqra, read." He answered, "Ma ana biqari'in," "I do not know how to read." And in that he depicted not only his condition, that he was illiterate, he was unlettered, but also the condition of the community and of the world at large. Then it is said that the angel said to him, "Iqra," and he again answered in the same manner. Then it is said that the angel recited, "Iqra bismi rabbika allazi khalaq," "Read in the name of thy Lord who has created the entire world and has created knowledge." "Iqra wa rabbuka al-akram," "Read, for thy Lord is most honorable and bestoweth honor." "Alladhi 'allama bil qalam," "Who bestoweth honor through the cultivation and communication of knowledge with the help of the pen." "Allama al-insana ma lam ya'lam," "In order to cause the stream of knowledge to flow from one generation to another and from one community to another." How amazing that the first message which this unlettered person living in the wilderness of Arabia of those days, where he had been surrounded for all these 40 years with unlettered and uneducated people, the first message that he claimed to have got from God, this word was "read." And not only the word "read," but that message mentioned that God Almighty is going to make those people alone honorable who are going to use the pen for the cultivation of knowledge. And the community which he was going to build up and establish under that message, it was made in this first revelation, one of the functions of that community, to unearth the buried treasures of knowledge, to revive them and to propagate them. "Allama al-insana ma lam ya'lam." He got the message and gave the message. And what do we find? This was, of course, the first message that he got, and he communicated it to mankind. Then he continued to get messages for 23 years, and those messages are recorded and compiled in the book which is called the Quran, the reading, because the first command had come, "Iqra," so the book is also called the Quran. It is a book which has got to be read and reread, which unfortunately the Muslims of today have completely forgotten. And because it has got to be read and reread, because the book is from the author of nature, from the author of this world, from the creator of this world, it has unfathomable layers of wisdom which can be found out only through reading and reading and re-reading and reading again. And consequently, the very name of this book is reading, the reading, Al-Qur'an. What was this message which the Quran brought? What was the message which this great man gave in the words of the Quran and in his own exposition of the Quran? Even today you will find that there is not much love lost between the followers of different creeds, between the followers of different religions. It is considered to be an act of piety to insult the follower of the religion of another religion. It is considered to be an act of the greatest virtue to hold the follower of another religion in contempt. But what did this man teach? What others had taught, I am not standing here to speak about that, but what did this man teach? He taught mankind to be first of all true to itself. He taught every human being to be first of all true to himself or herself, because he preached the basic doctrine which was not preached before him with the same emphasis. He preached the doctrine in the verse of the Quran, وَلَقَدْ كَرَّمْنَا بَنِي آدَمْ, where God Almighty says, I have made every human being, in virtue of his being a human being, honorable. And consequently, this great man laid down the law. All human beings are born free and equal. And it is an insult to humanity to insult another person. He preached the doctrine, which Muslims also have forgotten now, very unfortunately. He preached the doctrine and he gave this motto to the Muslims. Of course, it was meant for all mankind to follow, but it is an obligation on the Muslims who call themselves his followers. He laid down the motto of life, hate evil but not the evildoer, and appreciate good wherever it is found. Read the Quran and try to find out the outlook of this man as to why he was behaving in the manner that he was behaving. What was his attitude in propagating his message which he gave, which he regarded with the utmost depth of conviction as the absolute truth. A conviction which was so intense that there was absolutely no question of a compromise. But what was his attitude? What was his attitude towards the followers of other ideas, towards his worst enemies, towards his worst opponents? Read Suratul Kahf. And in this chapter, read the verse, فَلَعَلَّكَ بَاخِعٌ نَفْسَكَ عَلَىٰ آثَارِهِمْ إِلَّمْ يُؤْمِنُوا بِهَذَا الْحَدِيثِ أَسَفًا. God Almighty tells him, O Prophet, you love these infidels, these enemies of your message, who are all the time persecuting you and your followers. You love them so intensely that because they do not come to the right paths which you are preaching to them, which is the path of salvation for them, you remain so grieved at this that if this grief stays, it is going to take away your life. This is the translation of the verse. فلعلك باخع نفسك على آثارهم إن لم يؤمنوا بهذا الحديث أسف. Of course, his blind enemies, even today, the so-called Western Orientalists, for the past so many centuries, have been blackmailing him. And even today, if you go to Europe, you will find in those countries tender children, children of tender age being taught in their schools, printed in their books. Muhammad was a robber. He was a barbarian. He was a savage. And he built up a band of workers, of followers, who went out into the world with the sword in one hand and the Quran in the other to convert the people by force of arms and at the point of sword. There is no other instance of calling a white thing black. As black an instance as this. It was he who in the history of mankind laid down the law for the conversion of another person into Islam, laid down the law of freedom of conscience. The Quran proclaims, لا إكراه في الدين. Nobody can be compelled to accept any belief. There can be no compulsion in religion. This is the Quran. And the Islamic law lays down that if any Muslim tries the means of temptation or threat to convert a non-Muslim into Islam, it is the duty of the Islamic State to punish this Muslim and to help the person who has been threatened. Because according to the Quran, conviction without a rational basis and without the proper belief, belief without proper conviction is an absolute superstition. And every human being has dignity in his own right that he cannot be forced to abjure a certain belief and to say that he believes in something else. This is an insult to a human being according to the Quran. And God has made every human being possessor of dignity. Who was giving this message? Try to keep in your mind that age. Try to keep in your mind that environment. Those people out of whom he had sprung. People talk about fraternity, liberty and equality, that it was preached by Rousseau and Voltaire. Rousseau and Voltaire only stole those ideas from the Quran. These things were preached 1400 years ago by this great man. And what a greatness he had. He preached the doctrine of universalism of divine guidance. You will find it mentioned only in the Quran. The doctrine of the universalism of divine guidance, and of course that is logical and that is rational. If God is the God of all human beings, then he ought to have sent guidance not only to Palestine or Arabia, but to every single community of the world, whether they are the Bantus or Zulus, or they are the Eskimos of Greenland, because he cannot behave towards them in a stepfatherly fashion. And consequently, the Quran proclaimed, this great man in that wilderness proclaimed, لِكُلِّ قَوْمٍ هَذٍ. Every community of the world had divine messengers who came with message from God. And here, his followers were given, were put on a path of goodwill and harmony with other people, which cannot be found anywhere else. A Muslim, when he says that, when he makes his declaration of faith, he has got to say that I believe not only in Muhammad, but in all the divine messengers, whoever they were, and whenever they might have come, since the time of the first man, Adam. And if he says that I believe in Muhammad, but I don't believe in just one of them, he cannot be a Muslim. So a Muslim is he who has to proclaim among the known teachers of mankind, for instance, he has to proclaim that he is the follower of Muhammad and he is the follower of Jesus Christ and he is the follower of Moses and he is the follower of Abraham and so on. Even those whom a Muslim does not know as to who was the divine messenger, because history has mystified the stories of human beings and of nations, he cannot abuse, he cannot insult even the founder of a cult of, which might be today a cult of idol worship. Although a Muslim is an iconoclast, he believes only in one God and he cannot make any compromise in connection with this monotheism. He regards as blasphemy against God the making of any image or a statue or any type of figuration or imagery in connection with God. But even then, he cannot utter one word of abuse against anyone who is regarded as the founder even of a cult of idol worship. Because he might have been a real divine messenger, and the course of history has enshrouded him in all this in which people find him today. And he is a believer, he is a follower of all those divine messengers who had come from the time of Adam to the time of the Holy Prophet Muhammad alayhi salatu wasalam. So he cannot say this. For instance, when the Western Orientalists abuse Muhammad, we cannot abuse Jesus Christ. When a Jew abuses Muhammad, we cannot abuse Moses or Abraham. We cannot, because the moment we do it, we will be turned out of the fold of Islam. Right away, we cannot remain Muslim. Mind you, it is not a minor sin in Islam. He went to the length, to the extent of saying, do not abuse even the idols. Although he had come to break idols, break the idols, and to abolish idolatry, but he said, the words of the Quran are, وَلَا تَسُبُّ الَّذِينَ يَدْعُونَ مِن دُونِ اللَّهِ. Do not abuse these false deities which they worship. A Muslim's function is not to abuse. If he feels that there is a person or there is a community which is given to wrong beliefs or wrong actions, his function is not to abuse. His function is to feel sympathy for them and to invite them with love and affection, if he at all wants to do anything in that behalf. Who was teaching this? This man who was born in the wilderness of Arabia. This man who lived in the among the barbarians. He was not living in Greece, which had been a seat of learning. He was not born among the Romans, who had a glorious history. He was not born in Palestine or Syria, which had been seats of learning for thousands of years. He was not born in India, which had produced great philosophies and a very distinguished culture. This man was speaking like this. He was speaking of goodwill and harmony. He was speaking and not only speaking, practicing. And mind you, he was born among the Arabs. The Arabs were the most race-conscious people of ancient history. They regarded every non-Arab as merely a human animal and not a complete human being. They said this. Read their poetry of pre-Islamic days. And it was he who stood among them and said, لا فضل لعربي على عجمي ولا لعجمي على عربي كلكم من آدم وآدم من تراب. There is no superiority for the Arab over the non-Arab, nor is there any superiority of the white over the black. All of you are children of Adam, and Adam was made out of dust. And these proud Arabs shook with anger when he said this. They took up arms when he preached all those noble principles. They persecuted his followers. They persecuted him. They set a price on his head. For 13 years he preached. They were powerful. The worldly power was in their hands. They were powerful in numbers. They were powerful in their cult of idolatry, fellowship of the cult. Of course, you can say that he was not powerful. He had no power. He and his followers were just a handful. And so he could not react. Of course, even the worm turns. Even a child, if you misbehave towards a child, is going to frown at you, knowing very well that the child is a child and you are a grown-up person. That is human nature. But how did he behave? They would drag Muslims, his followers, on scorching sand with chains and thorns beneath them, which would tear their body into pieces. He never cursed. They would do every type of injury to him which they could possibly do. We do not find one instance in which he cursed. There is one incident only which I'll quote here. One day as he was coming, after giving his message to his opponents, they threw the intestines of a camel full of filth and dirt from the housetop on him. He was splashed with all that, but he continued to walk with the same dignity and serenity. We, the Muslims of today, would not tolerate even the slightest frown from any person. But what was the example set by him? He went to his home and asked his daughter Fatima to bring water. He changed his clothes, and those filthy and dirty clothes which had been made filthy and dirty, he took them in his hands and he started washing them. And when he was washing them, his daughter, who was yet very small, she was burning with rage, and she said to him, "O father, you are a man of God. Curse." And he smilingly looked at his daughter as he was washing that dirt and filth and said, "Dear, I have not been sent to curse. They will see the truth one day." When the people of Mecca did not listen to his message, he went from there to Taif, a place not far, I will say quite far away from Mecca. He went there on foot in the scorching heat of the sun with only one companion whose name was Zaid. And the chiefs of Mecca had sent the message to the chiefs at Taif that when he arrives there, he should be greeted with abuse and hooting by the hooligans of the town. And this they did. He was greeted in that fashion. He proceeded to the marketplace. Amidst all that hooting, he stood in the marketplace and gave the message to believe in the one God and to lead the life of goodness and righteousness. The hooligans spat on his face, and when he found that it was not possible for them to withhold him from speaking, they started stoning him. He was stoned to an extent that his entire body bled. Blood oozed out from different parts of his body, but he gave the message with the same serenity and dignity and calmness. And when he had given the message, he came out of the town, hooted by the hooligans. And when he was on his way to Mecca, he found a place, a small tree, where he could sit down and wipe off his wounds. And this man, Zaid, who was his companion, he said, "O Prophet of God, curse these people. They are cruel. Their behavior is highly inhuman." And as he was wiping the wounds, he looked at Zaid, who was standing by his side. He smiled, he put the cloth on that sand and raised his hands and said, "Allahumma ihdi qawmi fa innahum la ya'lam." "O Lord, guide these people, because whatever they have done to me because of ignorance. They do not know." Then, when he found that the persecution of his enemies in Mecca was not coming to an end, after 13 years of labors in Mecca, he asked his followers to migrate to Medina. And he himself migrated, and the message which he gave again to them, which the Muslims read without knowing probably, the message was, "قُلْ يَا أَيُّهَا الْكَافِرُونَ لَا أَعْبُدُوا مَا تَعْبُدُونَ وَلَا أَنْتُمْ عَابِدُونَ مَا أَعْبُدُ." O rejecters of truth, I do not worship that which you worship, and you do not worship that which I worship. Lakum dinukum waliya din. To you, your way of life, and to me, my way of life. No abuse and no curses. No demonstration of any anger or of any vengeance at all that persecution. And he leaves. They chase him. They twice arrived where he was resting on the way. He escaped miraculously, arrived in Medina. In Medina there had been a group of Muslims already, and these few Muslims from Mecca joined them. Medina had not known any state. He gave the first constitution of a state in the history of mankind, putting down the rights of minorities and everything there, putting down the functions of the judiciary and of the executive, and how to organize the state. That is again amazing. This unlettered person, from where did he get all this knowledge? There was no precedent. There was nothing which he could imitate or copy from anywhere. He established the state of Medina on the principles of justice and equity. His enemies followed him. They brought army. The first army they brought and invaded Medina. And the first battle took place at Badr. He had a much smaller army, only 313, ill-equipped, shabbily dressed, barefooted soldiers, or men facing an army armed to the teeth with helmets and armor and horses, 1,000 selected soldiers from Mecca. But they were routed miraculously. He took a piece of, he took a little earth in his hand and threw at them. And he stood there not to kill, but to invite them to truth. They did not. They attacked and they lost. Then they continued in that fashion. They sent out emissaries to other parts of Arabia, inviting alliance from others, until they could build up a huge army. This huge army could not be held up except by digging a ditch around Medina. How it happened is there given in the books of history. But this great army also was routed. In a miraculous fashion, then the time came. These waves out after waves were coming. Then the time came. The Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam left with all Muslims whom he could take with him for Mecca. And he asked their leaders to stop all their warfare and to behave as human beings. The truce of Hudaybiyah was signed. Certain conditions were laid down in that truce. His enemies broke those conditions. So he went again. He said, "What do you mean? Surrender! And it is again a miracle of history that they had to surrender. It is the one conquest which where blood was not shed. They were so overawed by this Muslim army, which was not very large, which was not larger than they could bring into the field, they surrendered. And then he said, at the same hill from where he had given his original message to believe in the one God and to adopt the life of goodness and righteousness. And those arch prisoners, those arch enemies, those leaders who had led the armies and who had killed Muslims and who had perpetrated all types of crimes of arson and loot and murder, they were brought before him in chains. He asked them, "Up to this time you were powerful. You held the power of government and all that in your hands. You did whatever you did during these 22 years. What do you think? How should I behave towards you today?" And they trembled. They knew that even the most civilized law of the world could not spare them their lives. But they also knew the greatness of this man, his forgiveness and his magnanimity and greatness of his soul. So they said in reply, "Thou art a good brother and a good nephew." That was the Arab idiom, which was a sort of appeal for mercy. And he said, "Yes, that I am. And I'll say to you the same thing which Prophet Joseph had said about his brothers who had been cruel to him. I'll say to you the same thing. اِذْهَبُوا أَنْتُمُ الطُّلَقَاءُ لَا تَثْرِيبَ عَلَيْكُمُ الْيَوْمِ يَغْفِرُ اللَّهُ لَكُمْ وَهُوَ أَرْحَمُ الرَّاحِمِينَ. Go, all of you are free today. No account will be taken from you of your crimes. And I pray to God to forgive you. I forgive you. And I pray to God to forgive you because He is the most merciful." This man who was born among the barbarians, were taking the blood of another person on the slightest pretext, was considered to be an act of chivalry. This man sets this example, which is unparalleled in the history of mankind. It was not merely a sermon to be merciful, it was an actual event. And the mercy was shown to the enemy. Today, Muslims, in their ignorance, do not wish to show mercy, which is unparalleled in the history of mankind. It was not merely a sermon to be merciful, it was an actual event. And the mercy was shown to the enemy. Today, Muslims, in their ignorance, do not wish to show mercy even to their neighbor. How far have we gone astray? How far have we gone astray? And how are we representing our leader, the Holy Prophet Muhammad alayhi salatu wa salam? Of course, the world saw that this band of Muslims whom the Holy Prophet Muhammad alayhi salatu wa salam had trained, they rose to be the mightiest force in the history of mankind for all that was good. They became the pioneers in the field of human relations. They wrote the most illuminating chapter in human history, where tribalism and racialism and caste system and serf and master and all these things were wiped off. In that society which Islam built up, they emerged in history as the teachers of every branch of knowledge to every part of mankind, to every part of this world, wherever they could go. They emerged as the standard bearers of the highest manifestations of morality. May I tell you, you can read in history certain things which are misrepresentations. I'll give you just one instance. And here also I'll challenge that the history of mankind cannot produce another event of this type. And this will also give the idea as to how a Muslim can practice and should practice Islam, not in this shabby manner in which we practice. This is not Islamic practice. This is the practicing of a sort of cult or of a sort of social heritage or of something which is just nominalism. Worshipping a name or caring for a name. Many of you must have heard the name of Sultan Salahuddin. Of course, his name has been very well known in Europe, where for centuries the mothers there used to calm their children by saying, "Saladin has come." His very name was made a sort of terror. But what type of man this man was? This Muslim. Long after the period of the Sahaba or the companions, when so much of waning of the spirit of the original spirit had come. All those who are students of history know about the Crusades. Crusades were the attempts by large armies of Europe to take away Palestine from the Muslims. These crusades continued for quite a long time until that crusade which was led by Richard the Lion-hearted King of England. In that crusade, the army of the crusaders was able to conquer Palestine and to capture Jerusalem. The Muslim army was defeated. And when these crusaders entered Jerusalem, their own historians write this, that they killed every Muslim man and woman and child inside that city. So much so that when their horses went into the city, the horses had to wade through blood of these innocent people up to the knees. This tragedy had happened when after some time this small chieftain, Salahuddin al-Ayyubi, who was not the caliph of Islam, who was not the head of the Islamic empire, but who was only a small chieftain, brought up in the monastery of Ghausul Azam Sayyid Abdul Qadir al-Jilani, educated and trained there spiritually and academically, this man stood up with his small army and went to fight the battle with those crusaders who were in command of that city and of Palestine itself. The army of these crusaders was about 10 times larger than the army of Sultan Salahuddin. The battle started. It raged for several days. When the commander-in-chief of the army of the crusaders, King Richard the Lion-Hearted, he was badly wounded. And this gave the Muslims the opportunity to strike the hardest in order to win the battle. But what did Salahuddin do? When he found that the army, the commander-in-chief of this army which had killed his own people like that, as I told you, which was 10 times larger in numbers, when this commander-in-chief, he found that he was badly wounded, he raised the flag of truce. He said, "We are Muslims. We will not continue the fight because the commander-in-chief of the enemy has been badly wounded and our enemy is now handicapped. I have not